Hello, you're listening to Talking Tales, the podcast. What you're about to hear is a live recording from the Talking Tales Storytelling Night, held in Bristol and hosted by Stokescroft Writers. To find out more, visit www.stokescroftwriters.com. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome this evening. Welcome to the Bristol Festival of Literature Speakeasy. That's what I'm here for. I hope it's what you're here for. I'm going to carry on that assumption. My name's Yari, and I'm the founder of the Bristol Festival of Literature, and I'm really proud to say this is our fifth speakeasy, and I would like you all to give yourselves a round of applause just for showing up tonight, because I'm really pleased to see you. So it's been a great week so far, and it ain't finished yet. It's going to finish much, much later tonight. And I want to thank all the wonderful event organisers that have been involved so far this week. And we'll come back to that at the end of the night. But first of all, I just want to say that tonight we've got the wonderful Talking Tales who are going to look after you for the bulk of the evening. I'm going to come back again a little bit later and introduce you to a novelist, a young person's novelist. Ooh. And I'd like to hear us kind of think about what it is that young people are reading at the moment, and just a slight diversion, slight digression from some of the kind of like crime and evil dark stuff that we tend to look at, or not. Maybe I won't deviate at all. Maybe that's exactly what we'll look at. We'll talk to Tracy Alexander after the break. But just before we get to that point, the festival is all about literature. And it's all about what we read. So what have I been reading? I've just finished a novel called The Beggar and the Hare by a Finnish novelist called Tuomas Kyrö, which is spelled K-Y-R-O, Kyrö. And absolutely wonderful story about it's a very quirky, very funny little novel about a Romanian refugee who is actually kidnapped and trafficked into Scandinavia, sort of like halfway between how can I put it? It's a very quirky sort of Scandi crime idea, really. It's a wonderful novel, really uplifting, really uplifting. So I recommend Tuomas Kyrö, The Beggar and the Hare, to any of you. It's available in Waterstones. That's where I got it, anyway. I don't know what else you are reading. I don't know what you're up to at the moment. Why don't you just turn to the person next to you and just, or the people you're with, especially if it's someone you don't normally talk to. If you live with this person, you might know what they're reading. Just ask, so what are you reading at the moment? And listen, right, we've all got a copy of Dostoevsky on the shelf. If no one can say, look, I'm not reading anything, because you are. You're reading the street signs. You're reading the packets in the supermarket. You're building up this amalgam of sticky stuff. What are you reading at the moment? Fantastic. Have you all asked everyone you're around? Have you exchanged your ideas already? I tell you what, this ain't no library in here, is it? Okay. I'm going to hand over in a second, but I just want to say a word before I go about literature. In my view, literature is about creating lies in order to convey the truth. And sometimes that truth is just that we need to escape. Sometimes that truth is just that, you know, we've got death peering over our shoulders eventually, and we just want to have a kind of a resolution to that while we're here. We want to be taken to strange new places. We want to be shown who we are. That's what literature is about, using the creative word in all its formats to do that. And you're going to hear some wonderful examples of that this evening. Brilliant stuff. I'm just going to mention as well, Long for the Coast have got some CDs available. If anybody this evening's got merch, honour their merch, man. Buy some merch. So they've got CDs available. I've suggested they spread them around in a slightly more accessible place than behind the microphone, but you'll have a chance to do that later. So Long for the Coast have got a wonderful CD out, and I'll tell you a story about that later, no doubt. Some of our authors will be having books on sale as well, no doubt, so keep your eyes open for that. And I hope you have a wonderful evening this evening. I'm going to hand over to Christy, who's going to take you through the rest of the evening. And I'll see you just after the break. Thank you.
Hello. Hello. So welcome to this very special edition, Bristol Festival edition of Talking Tales. Talking Tales is hosted by Stokescroft Writers, who I'm representing this evening. And Talking Tales is put on to showcase all the amazing writing talent throughout Bristol and beyond, and we have 7 fantastic short story and flash fiction writers on this evening. We'd also like you to get involved. So on your tables, if you haven't found it already, is the Finish the Line worksheet, because we're worksheet kind of people. So if you could fill it out, we'll be collecting them during the break. And the best of each line will, the top 3 will win an exciting top of the range, limited edition Talking Tales badge. Thank you very much. I didn't know how that was going to go, so thank you for supporting that. We'll be passing around a bucket for donations to support the festival, Desperate Writers, and Max, the starving sound guy, so he can buy fruit pastels, dog biscuits, and the like. Max in the corner. So give generously. So Max is helping us do a podcast, which we do every time. So that'll be available on iTunes afterwards. So for all the, just a quick reminder for all the readers this evening to talk into the microphone, or one of Stokescroft writers will come and shove your face into it, which isn't nice. So let's not do that. Okay, so the set list is on your tables if you want to know who's coming up. So let's get started. All right. Andy Mel Hewish can only write in the dark, in a small wardrobe with the door closed, so that he's not aware he's doing it, and definitely not if he's looking. As he's becoming more successful, he's hoping to move to a bigger wardrobe. Do your best clapping, please, for Andy Mel Hewish.
Lies. Am I too close or too far away? La-da-do. Okay, here we are. Hi, sorry. I'm suddenly rather nervous. Normally, we don't have such a crowd in, usually. I'm a little bit complacent about this sort of thing, but you guys are real. Okay. So I had intended to write and consequently read something good, but other stuff got in the way, so I'm reading this instead. I promise it'll be over in like 2 minutes. That's what he said. Some of you may know it. I keep a website which is not my name website. It's called Eloquent Bear. And for some reason I started doing stories featuring this character of the Eloquent Bear. And I'm not really sure if he's like just a really hairy man or an actual bear that can talk. But you can fill it in yourself. So, this is called Eloquent Bear's Locked Door Mystery. The three of them stand in the kitchen and watch the large man try to fit through a window too small for people. Political discussion on the radio keeps things relaxed, and they're finishing the last of a cafetiere and wondering if it's the last, and wondering if it's time to open the wine. And they watch this man fall from a sill into a small pile of unrecycled recycling outside. Little Bear tries to open the door one last time. The handle turns, but still it will not open. The man now kneels on the other side, visible through the frosted glass. There is hope that he knows what to do. "We tried jiggling it," says Little Bear, unsure if the man can hear her. "Shh," says Eloquent Bear. "We already told him that. It's embarrassing." "I'm sure we could have done it eventually," says Mouse, who will end up paying the bill for all of this. "He is a large man, isn't he?" says Little Bear. "Where's his accent from, do you think?" asks Mouse. "I can hear you," says the man. There's little they can do, it seems, so Mouse goes to find a bottle and Little Bear goes to find some glasses. Eloquent Bear keeps watching the man as a form of helping, slowly getting more anxious that he is, in fact, useless. Eventually, he thinks, the man's going to need a tool from this bag, or a cup of tea, or a big round glass of red. And when that moment comes, Wine bear, says Mouse. Ah, he says, just what I was thinking about. The radio discussion has moved on, and terrifying news about immigration fills the room, with classical music scheduled after. The bears and the mouse drink their wine and watch, staring through a wide window into the garden that mocks them with its sunny expanses and dappled shade. I see the problem, says the large man. Just. He tinkers with the mechanism with care and strength. I suppose, says Eloquent Bear, this is how we all are, all the time. Doesn't matter the size of the room or even the size of the windows. We've trapped ourselves. Whether it's international borders or our own hearts, somehow we've broken the lock. Are you drunk already, Bear? Asks Mouse. Quite a bit, it seems. Just there, says the man, his voice suddenly unmuffled as the door swings open. Ah, excellent, says Mouse. All done, then. No, the lock is fucked. I'll have to install a new one. Couple of hundred. I'll just go and check in my van. The end.
Thank you, Andy. Okay, next up. Joe Smith. This is the theme, so get behind it. Joe Smith only sees in the colour blue. He's been trying to invent the other colours for years in foolhardy money-making schemes that's seen him lose his life savings, his dignity and his sense of smell. In other news, he works as a teaching assistant and writes short fiction and criticism in his spare time. Clap like your hands are on fire for Joe Smith! Whoever he is! Come on, Joe.
I'll use this one. It makes me feel taller, I suppose. I don't have much of a preamble, so I'm just going to get started. I've got a story called Sketches of Jealousy. Well, how'd you do it? How'd you do it other than wildly accusing her of sleeping with someone else? But no, sorry, rather of thinking, of dreaming, of imagining, of turning over in the night and seeing in the dark. How do you approach that? Darling, just casually, darling, I don't mean to pry, but did you, just to know, did you dream about, do you ever imagine, or ever see in the dark when you turn over, when there is only the softly penetrating sound of duvets and pillows under drowsy hands, a man, another man, a specific man? No? Well, I'm pretty sure you do, so would you kindly admit to it? Ben Crumple paced back and forth over the kitchen floor. He had an unsettling notion that Clarence was passionately, privately thinking about someone else. He spun ideas through his head and paced diligently until, perhaps he hoped, one idea might find traction and could be carried through. But what idea could? Powered by a slipshod dynamo, his mind was simply unable to stay on one thought or another. Why did she say this or that? Why did she laugh then? With the other man, her friend perhaps, before they'd met? Suspicious laughter, happiness, a rising heat in his face, and hot guttural feelings in his feet. The need to leave the room where he watches her from the corner of his eye as she talks and laughs and shows signs of actual, genuine happiness when talking to a man who is not him. The dynamo spins, turned by some pathetic inward oppressor. But this memory, is it possible? Is that how she actually acted? Crumple has turned on himself and asks, did she laugh? Did she touch his arm when she did so? Did she look into his eyes like that? Watch his mouth as he spoke? Now, Ben, I'm going to ask you to be wary here. Can your memory really help you out? The image has already been prepared in your mind, has already worked the beginnings of its imprint into the past event. Did she, you ask yourself? Did she? But there, the memory is formed by the question. The kitchen was lit by an early winter lunchtime light. The floor had been swept. He'd swept it that morning. He had the day off from work, but sweeping the kitchen was about all he had managed to do with his time. He couldn't manage anything else and could hardly bear to eat his lunch. He could only think about her, at her place of work, in her own ashen lunchtime light, and her at night, in the darkness, stirring in the muffling duvet. Was she thinking of him? The other him? He sits down. Just for a moment, there is peace in the kitchen. Lunchtime sediments itself in the outside world, and there is a sense that it will be difficult to go back to work after such a low-lit lunch break. The garden, untidy, as so many shared house gardens are, is still. The greyness of the light is hypnotising, and the ivy gradually curls into spirals over the paving stones. How typical. A paved, untidy, shared house garden greying on an early winter lunch break. And perhaps it's also becoming typical that Ben Crumple would sediment himself into this slow and unwinding scene. I ask, again in my ham-fisted contemporary style, what's wrong, Ben? Pick yourself up a bit and ask yourself, please, what is wrong? I know it's easy to think grey thoughts when even the air itself... But before I can finish, Crumple is up. Ben Crumple is up and out of his seat, out of the kitchen door and heading towards the stairs. Where's he going? Purposeful footsteps rise up the stairs. Doof, doof, doof. Then comes manic shuffling in the room above. What's he looking for? But before we can find out, he leaps down the stairs, his internal engine shooting him out the door, which slams behind him like a trap. And an otherworldly silence stirs and awakens in the kitchen. I'm shuffling through a pile of miscellaneous quotes. Let me find one which will work for us. Here, I think this one will do. It's from Othello. Now, Iago openly tells Rodrigo, I am not who I am. But wait, as I remember it, these words not only refer to Iago himself, but... Now, how far can we stretch this? They also act as a kind of magic spell, which, when one feels an alteration has occurred in one's relationship with another, starts to stir and drift over one's thoughts and actions. I am not who I am. I am not who I am. Crumple will likely start to notice it, start to say it to himself, after Clarence has left one evening, when he's driven her out by asking her too many times what she's doing tomorrow night with her friends. In any case, he won't murder her in a jealous rage, which is clearly a positive thing, and nor will any Iago seek fateful revenge on him. Instead, life, this life anyway, Crumple's life, as far as it goes, untidy lunchtime gardens, cracked paving, shared houses, rummaging in the room above the kitchen. In September, Clarence had wanted her walk to work to never end. She wanted the bright russet morning to expand over everything. She wanted to sit, and like the countless Septembers when she was in college, she wanted to read her book in the park. Under the auburn canopy of the parkland trees through which she walked to work, she had often dreamed about not having to check in with Ben, not having to see him, for what felt more and more like God knows what reason why. As each time he'd look at her in a strange way, or endlessly quiz her about what she was doing, over and over again into the dull night. She no longer wanted to spend her evenings thinking about it. She wanted to go to work and come back from work, to see her friends, and maybe, well, she wanted something, but she wasn't sure what. Only that it should be something bright and something pleasantly chilly. But here, look, I found another quote. This one's translated from a book on Leonardo da Vinci. This one might work. I really hope so. I'll read it. The swollen waters gyrate in the lake that contained them, and the eddying vortices percussively strike diverse objects and leap into the air with muddy spume, then falling back, making rebounds in the air with percussed water. So this quote by Da Vinci does not describe the feelings or actions of one who is jealous, but in fact refer to the physical motions and effects of the great deluge from the Book of Genesis. The deluge was God's attempt to reconfigure the world, to restart it all, to return to the beginning. Please, perhaps he never thought to ask, can we at least try? Clarence also wishes to return to a certain situation which does not necessarily prefigure strange feelings and questioning looks in the evening, and, well, possibly also autumn shadows in the morning, or even in the late afternoon, with the school children milling around outside the newsagents, spilling out onto the corner of the park and arguing quite seriously about nothing. Did God, also with a typical cataclysmic force, also wish for lengthening shadows and chilly bright days? Days in which he could sit out in the park, even having to wear his coat, and read his book? If we presume he can, in fact, read. While the school children nattered and argued and broke apart as the shadows lengthened further, and the damp chestnut leaves on the path, and the senses of the evening, and the quietness, and this emotion which, if he were describing the psychological state of jealousy as a set of physical motions, which, let's be honest with ourselves here, he never really was, Da Vinci had left out, quietness, back at home sat on his low bed. Clarence hadn't picked up her phone, and he is worried that if he calls her again, it might seem strange. And the room is growing darker, quicker than it is outside, due to the sun setting behind the house. Thank you.
Keep it going for Joe! Thank you, Joe! Okay, the last story of this... The last story of this half is by Mark Rutterford. Is the original James from James and the Giant Peach. He had to change his name for privacy reasons. He doesn't like peaches. Do lots of applause for Mark!
Hello, just to kick this off, I should say that if you're a writer that likes telling stories, then this is just the best fun there can be. So thank you to the Bristol Festival of Literature, and thank you to Stokescroft Writers. And I'll get a little bit closer to the mic to read the story. Very delicately done. Thank you. The late summer daylight refused to yield. The sky backlit as if a theatre stage. Deferential stars stood in the wings, awaiting direction and their cue to appear. They would flood the sky later, as complete as the filling up of the oceans, their drop-by-drop arrival as imperceptible as the spinning of the earth. And to the north, the light of Venus shone like love itself, bright and complete. The hard earth helped Joe make steady progress. His destination, the peak of a hill so isolated in the landscape, it might have been lonely had it not stood so proud. A single tree on the summit provided testimony to perseverance. As he reached the top, the last eddies of evening breeze had submitted to the still of the night. Joe listened for the bubbling of the black soup that had engulfed the fields around him. He could feel the heat, but not even that could be heard. It was dusk, and Joe had remembered. "I'll miss you, my love," he had said in the days before Mary passed away. "I'll never be far," she had replied. "Talk to me any time, I'll be listening. Or write me a letter in the sky, promise?" "All right, promise, but you know me and letters." That was last November. Joe took the metal rod from his bag and a lighter from his pocket. The still and silent air hardly made the flame flicker, and then vibrant brightness blinded Joe as the sparkler became his quill. "Dear Mary, happy anniversary. 43 years of marriage. I can't believe it. Thank you for every day." "It doesn't get any easier without you, and the farm is getting harder to run each year. So many things to go wrong, so many things you used to do for me. I don't want a lady friend, but I could do with a housekeeper. Those two young'uns I took on, they're looking out for me and keeping up with regulations. I say young'uns, they're both 30-something. Tom is good with the heavy work, and Sarah's great with the flock too, and drives the tractor like it's a racing car. She knelt on the kitchen floor in February, warming a lamb in front of the stove. Remember doing that? Of course you do. It was sleeting, and she'd picked up your old hat from the rail. As I walked in for a cup of tea, there was a moment when I thought you'd come back to me. I was so happy for a few seconds. Then she spoke and sounded nothing like you. So I had to tell her it was so cold out there, my eyes were watering. That was the hardest, I think. I still miss you as much as ever. I was dreading today, to be honest. But then I've been writing this letter in my head for the last week, and it's helped. I'm slowing up a bit more, but at 68, what should I expect? Still good for another 10 years on the farm, I reckon, and 10 or 20 after that. Maybe not all of those. I might have to start up this hill in May to be here mid-July. Come on, Joe, I can hear you now, all vexed and impatient. The kingfishers are in the brook again, and the foxes plentier than ever. I know how you love them. I hope that God is treating you well, and the angels are waiting on you hand and foot. Could you put in a word for a drop of rain, please, at night, when the cows are in? We'll talk in the morning, and I'll write again next year. Up here seems closer to you. Oh, and Mary, I love you, still and always. Joe. Joe drew a heart then, and inside it he drew a cross. Then he shut his eyes, put his hand to his lips, and threw the kiss into the sky. That was lovely. A female voice from behind Joe made him jump. He wondered if it was the tree at first, but then the gloom yielded a woman. Her features were lost to the dark, but her blonde hair shone like a beacon. It was the radiated glow of her mobile phone, and with it, the crass interruption of something personal, something that belonged in another time. What are you doing hiding on me and intruding? Go on, get on home, Joe scolded. I'm sorry, I'm really sorry, the woman said. She seemed genuinely upset, a little tearful, Joe thought, which is exactly the state she had been in for some hours. I came up here to think, to stop thinking, I don't know. Down there, my world is full of difficult decisions and hurt I have to cause or pain I have to suffer. I was here before you, anyway. Oh, were you now, young lady? Joe said. Laura. Well, Laura, I was here in the summer of 1971, on one knee as Mary leant against that tree and said she would marry me. We came here every summer, and now it's me on my own since she... Don't say it. The woman pleaded. I can't bear to hear it, not today, and not to take the shine off your speech. Letter. It's the most, well, I think it's very special to have a love like that. I've been trying to decide what to do. I'm no clearer than I was, to be honest. You're more likely to find the answer in the sky than on that thing, Joe admonished the phone once more. I bet your apples and your clouds are different to mine, Laura said, but it has its uses. So what's eating you up then, young lady? I'm 28, completely in love and pregnant. Congratulations! Not really. The father, the man I'm in love with, is Rod. He makes me laugh, unless we're talking about his wife and twin girls. This wasn't planned, but I do want a baby, his baby, our baby. Do I tell him? Do I keep it? Laura started to cry again, and Joe couldn't help but put his arms round her. After a minute, she continued. I rent a flat that's too damp for me to live in, never mind a child. My wage barely covers my rent, and if I'm honest, I know Rod won't leave his wife. I don't want to take his money from him. It'll feel like he has bought me, and I'm not for sale. As Laura's tears subsided, Joe summoned up all his years of wisdom. Well, Laura, there's only two things that solves problems better than the night sky. One of them is time, and the other is tea. I bet you feel differently if you were stood here in a year's time. And you see that farmhouse over there? I happen to know it has a great kettle. And on the way down, You can try and convince me that there's some good in that phone of yours. Exactly 1 year later, Joe walked up the hill once more. It was cloudy and cool, a night without heat or stars. Joe figured that he would make this journey for as many years as he was able. He would be there, a fixture, like the tree. At the top of the hill, Joe fought a breeze to light his sparkler. At the fourth attempt, it caught, and he started to write. Dear Mary, happy anniversary. 44 years of marriage. Thank you for every day. It's been quite a year, oh, I know you know that, but bear with me. Where to start? That girl, Laura. Joe went on to describe the cup of tea with Laura last year and her dilemma. Holed up in a dingy flat, unable to make ends meet, and with a baby on the way, perhaps. I could see she was as bright as a button, Mary. Perhaps not the brightest when it came to falling in love, but not everyone's as lucky as you and me, girl. By late October, Laura had become Joe's housekeeper, on a trial they both knew she was unlikely to fail. Laura had worked hard looking after the farmhouse, and after a surprisingly short period of adjustment, they had grown closer than householder and housekeeper. Joe relayed all of this in a letter full of excitement, much more news than a 5-minute sparkler could cover. The ending of Joe's letter, the declaration of love, the heart with the kiss inside it, they were no less sincere for being written in the darkness. Just after Joe had thrown his kiss into the night, Laura pressed send on a text message. She walked from the tree to Joe's side and briefly rested a hand on his shoulder. You were right. You said I'd feel different in a year's time. Thank you, Joe. For what? For making this possible. Laura pointed to the baby in her arms. For being a good man and still caring. And for loving Mary. I'm in awe of that. Joe wrinkled his nose. Do you think she's listening? Laura asked. Oh, I like to think so, Joe replied. Well, I think you reap what you sow. And you sow the best I have ever known, Joe. And all that love, it comes back to you. Laura pointed out into the night and said, Look. Joe peered out into the gloom. Then one by one, the stars came out. Not in the sky, but in the land that he and Mary had worked all their lives. Twinkling spots of light lit up the fields and hills before his disbelieving eyes. Joe put his hand to his mouth as he made out the illuminated wording and let a tear trickle down his cheek. Laura stood 6 feet away. She was filming the spectacle with her phone to share with co-conspirators and subsequently about 1 million people on YouTube. It was in a blog that Laura shared the story of Joe's wedding anniversary letter in the sky. It had generated a storm of interest and captured the imagination of hundreds of volunteers. They were there now in the darkness, holding up 1,000 sparklers, fizzing into life. It was as if the stars had come down to earth and illuminated the hills in a sparkling message that read, Still and always, love you, Mary. Joe felt a kiss on his cheek. He glanced to his right and no one was there. He glanced to his left and Laura was still 6 feet away. So he looked to the sky. Thank you.
Big round of applause for Mark! Woo! We have a bit more time in the first half than I expected, so I'm going off-piste. It's going to be pretty exciting. So I'm going to fit one more into the first round. I'm just going to move a bit because I am aware there are other people over there. Okay, so next up. Christy Cluett enjoys talking about herself in the first person and therefore has no friends. Okay. Hold on, can we find some light? So this is the 52nd birthday in bed. Hold on, if I can read it.
I think it's time we had our own beds,
said Roy, in a small room that smelled of TCP and stale air, dominated by one lumpy double bed. Do you, Roy? Does he, Maud? Sally said, looking back and forth between her siblings, twisting a strand of hair that had fallen out of its curler. No, he doesn't think that at all, said Maud, smoothing the orange polyester coverlet. She was sitting up, poker straight, on the right-hand side, refusing to look at either of them, and instead staring off to the right at the faded pink flowers of the wallpaper.
It's our birthday. I'm 52 years old, and I think it's time I had my own bed, Roy said, with his arms crossed.
He straightened the sleeves of his striped pyjamas and shot an angry look at Maud. Don't be ridiculous, Roy, said Maud. We've always shared a bed, ever since Mother gave birth to us. Anyway, I came out first, so I make the decisions, and I say one bed is just fine. Sally agrees, don't you, Sally? Sally twisted her hair faster as she nodded. Yes, Maud. Maud, can I have my pillow back? Maud stared straight ahead. Stop being selfish, Sally. You know my back hurts, and if we're bringing it up, my back hurts because of the way you sleep. Sorry, Maud.
I want my own bed, said Roy.
Roy, you are ruining the birthday for Sally. Now light the candles so we can blow them out and go to sleep, said Maud. The cake rested on the coverlet in front of them, chocolate, as it was every year.
No.
Roy recrossed his arms and turned his head away. Maud, can I have my own bed? Sally was fiddling with a thread from Maud's pillowcase. See what you've done, Roy? Do you? You made Sally think. Maud glared at the back of Roy's head.
Sally can have her own bed too, said Roy to the wall.
Can I? Sally's face was a curious mix of excitement and fear. No, you can't. Hold the cake still, said Maud, and Sally reached out to grab it.
Yes, she can. We can all have our own beds. In fact, we should have our own beds. I think it's got weird, said Roy.
We're fine as we are. Sally, move your foot. It's been over my side for 3 minutes now, said Maud.
I'm going to sleep on the floor, said Roy said,
and pulled back the coverlet, brown blanket and sheet as one. Roy, don't you move. Who'll light the candles? You've got the matches. Anyway, you know Sally can't sleep unless we're all together, said Maud. Well, said Sally. Be quiet, Sally.
I've met someone, said Roy,
with one arm raising the sheets, but still in the bed. What? When? Said Maud.
Her name's Pam, and she delivers the post. She said it's weird we still share a bed, and that I should get my own bed, said Roy.
Pam has no idea what she's talking about. She hasn't even been in this house, said Maud.
Well,
said Roy. What do you mean, well?
I invited her to the birthday.
But we always have the birthday in bed.
Right, that took some convincing, he said. Hello,
said a muffled voice. Jesus Christ, is she in here, Roy? This was not discussed, said Maud.
She's in my third of the bed. Anyway, we're in love.
No, you're bloody well not. Not in this bed, you're not, are they, Sally? Said Sally, still thinking about her own bed. Sally, they are not in love, said Maud, the pitch of her voice rising.
Yes, we are, said the muffled voice. Can I have some cake?
Roy, keep Pam under control. Sally, where's Sally gone? In the middle of the bed was just a Sally-shaped depression. I want my own bed. I'm going to sleep in the wardrobe, she said from the other side of the room. Are you listening to yourself, Sally? That makes no sense. And what about the birthday cake? See, Roy, you and Pam have driven Sally to distraction. Sally, get back in the bed. Who knows what will happen to you without us, said Maud. No, I can't hear you from in here anyway. Good night, said Sally from inside the wardrobe. Are you happy now, Roy? Maud asked, her voice now quite shrill.
Well, there's more room for Pam now.
There was a lot of shuffling from Roy's third of the bed, and the top of Pam's head appeared. I don't like this. I don't like this at all, said Maud.
Go to sleep, Maud, said Roy.
I will not. In fact, if this is how you want it, I'll go and sleep in Mother's bed. And I'm taking the cake with me. Maud grabbed the cake and started to shuffle out of her side.
You can't do that,
said Roy. Why not? You've changed the rules, Roy. Anything goes. Anyone can sleep at anyone else's bed on their birthday. So I can get in Mother's, said Maud, standing next to the bed with a cake in her hands. Go on then, said Roy. Maud paused, her face deciding on an expression.
Well, Maud, go on then. We won't stop you.
Sally, did you hear me? I'm going to sleep in Mother's bed, called Maud. I heard you, said Sally's muffled voice. You're not going to stop me, Sally? No. Fine. Maud turned in what she hoped was a dramatic spin, but found that was difficult to pull off in a toweling nightgown. You're in a wardrobe, Sally. Either speak up or open the door, said Roy. Sally opened the door. I said, do you really think she's going?
I don't know, said Roy.
No one's even been in Mother's room since the 40th birthday, since she told us to go to bed, and then she never came back. Not even supposed to get out of the bed on birthday, said Sally, tufts of hair visible through the crack in the wardrobe doors.
Oh no, Sally, oh no.
I've had enough... Oh, hold on. I've had enough of this, Roy. Let's go to my bed, said Pam, sitting up with flat hair and an annoyed expression.
Your bed, Pam? What for?
Well, your sisters aren't in it, for one. Do I really need a second?
But,
said Roy. But what?
They aren't in it now.
I thought you loved me, Roy, said Pam, wrapping her arms around his neck. The wardrobe door closed.
I do. It's just I didn't realise I'd be expected to love you in a different bed.
Pam's arms dropped from his neck. Fine, then I'm leaving. Happy birthday, Roy. Pam ran out of the room in her Postman Pat pyjamas, tears welling in her eyes. Has she gone? Maud's head appeared round the door jamb.
I thought you were sleeping in Mother's bed, said Roy,
listening to Pam stamp down the stairs. I won't be driven out of my bed, Roy, not by you or that postal whore you brought in here. Anyway, it's the birthday, isn't it, Sally? Said Maud, getting back into bed. Yes, Maud, said Sally, opening the wardrobe door. Shall I get back in bed? Yes, Sally, it's time to blow out the candles, said Maud, putting the cake back on the bed. Sally climbed up the middle of the bed like a woman half her age. Roy, stop sulking and light the candles, said Maud. Roy sighed heavily, pulled out the matches and lit the 52 candles as his sisters watched. The three of them leaned forward and as one blew out their birthday candles. We'll always spend the birthday together, won't we? Said Sally.
It's not the birthday I'm concerned about. It's the other 364 days in this bed, said Roy.
Shut up, Roy, said Maud. Night, Maud. Night, Roy, said Sally, shunting down in the bed and pulling the duvet up to her chin.
Night, Sally, Roy said.
Night, Sally, Maud said, as Maud turned out the light.
Thank you.
Up the first half. One last pause for all the writers in the first half, please. Okay, we're going to take a short break and you have about 15 minutes and then back for round two. It's not a boxing match. Okay, thank you.
Every song that we say, be loud and from the heart, be loud and from the heart. May every lie we've been told get spat back, torn apart, get spat back, torn apart. May this feeling last forever, may these fires always burn. Sure, sometimes I've had our doubts and sometimes working insecure, still won't carry any world in our hearts. So bring the rain and ruins, thrive, not the slightest doubt. We can accommodate ourselves through the worst. For as we have built these cities, built these palaces once before, we'll build others when we inherit this earth. And we'll carry a new world in our hearts. and we'll carry a new word in us. Still laugh tonight and dry our eyes while this racket falls apart. Still we'll carry a new word in our hearts. Every back road that we blindly wandered down, somehow and back on track, somehow and back on track. May every last minute of our lives that they've claimed tonight be stolen back, tonight be stolen back. May these shows go on forever, may these highways never stop. This will never be replaced, exploited cults never bore. Still we'll carry a new world in our hearts. So bring the rain and ruins, for I've not the slightest doubt we can accommodate ourselves through the worst. For it is we who built these cities, built these palaces once before. We got nothing to lose and our whole lives left to gain. And we'll carry a new world in our hearts. And we'll carry a new world in our hearts. So we'll laugh tonight and dry our eyes. Well, this racket falls apart, but still we'll carry our new world here in our hearts.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I think we've got Yari back on the mic.
Thank you, Long for the Coast, and they'll be back with us after the second half. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you please to welcome a special guest for this evening. I'd like you to welcome a novelist, a children's and young adults novelist. I'm sure I'm going to get corrected on all of these things. Could you put your hands together, please, for Tracy Alexander. Come and have a chat. Make yourself nice and comfortable. We're just going to make ourselves comfortable here for a sec. Are you all right there?
I don't want her to push my face. Like she said, she was going to push my face.
You can either use the stick or you can pick it up.
Is this right? Don't move your head.
I've just discovered why there's tape on this piece.
All right, Yari?
Yes, I'm very well, thanks. Yes.
All right.
Gosh, it's been quite a week, hasn't it?
No, not for me.
Not for you. No, you've been relaxing. We've been doing festival. Yes, you've been taking it easy. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like...
Okay, I want to do that too.
You want to do this too?
Yeah, because right, I feel like this is my nose.
Okay, stand back. Nose is going to fire off.
Okay.
Let's untwist it a bit.
Okay.
And you wait for it. There we go. Is that a bit better?
That's better.
That's a bit easier, isn't it? But these things do stick in your face a bit. So, Tracy has sort of two names in my world. There's T.M. Alexander.
Yep.
And now there's Tracy Alexander. You've got a couple of books. I've got a couple of books. Okay. So, Tracy has been a really good friend of the festival and done a tremendous amount of work with us, with the children and... Now, is it young people or young adults? Okay, you're not going to straighten me out and hit me with your microphone, okay. So my terminology can be whatever I choose it to be. So what I thought would be really interesting for us tonight is to have a chat with someone who's not writing kind of stuff for the grown-up market or not writing kind of the sort of things that necessarily you've been listening to this evening, but is writing for a completely different understanding of the world, actually. And I know many of you guys will have kids out there. I've got a couple of primary-age kids, and they've loved your earlier series, the Tribe
series. Yay.
Yay for the Tribe series. Yay. And now, of course, you've kind of... What do we do? Do we diversify? Do we grow up a bit? What do we do?
Well, the real truth is that I wrote the Tribe books when my children were that sort of age. So my children were like, I don't really remember, but 5, 7, and 9, and I wrote something that I thought they would like and that they would find funny and stuff. And then my children grew up, and then I wrote something that I thought they might like now that they are teenagers. And actually, there's nothing more complicated than that, actually.
Do they say, Mum, write us a story, read us a story. Do they still want you to read? How old are you?
No, they swear and things. They don't go, Mum. No, they swear. But I just mean that I was immersed in teenage children, so I wrote a teenage book. And before that, you know, I didn't. Because actually, I'd like to think that I could say something very clever about why I chose to write what I wrote, but it hasn't been like that at all. It's just that I wrote about things I see around me, which is what I've sort of always done. And so I was around with a lot of teenagers, and so I wrote a couple of teenage novels. And because teenagers know about everything nowadays, I wrote two books that are quite hot potato issues kind of thing.
Go on then.
Did I say hot potato? Thanks, whoever laughed over there. You're my favourite. You can come up here. So actually there was no method, really, just
to your madness.
No.
So what is a hot potato? Tell me about the hot potato. Should I be worried now? What are you trying to tell my kids?
Actually, there is a bit. I tried to write sex a little bit, a bit that would be acceptable for school libraries. And I didn't really want to write it, but I thought that, you know, teenagers have sex. I'm sorry if that's going to frighten any of you, but they do. And so
close
I wrote
ears,
it and
Adam.
I was...
Close your ears.
I was quite subtle. And I was brilliantly subtle, because then when I said to the children, I said, what did you think about the bit? Nobody has spotted the bit. Nobody knows the bit. It's so subtle that nobody knows they had sex. They did have sex in the middle of the book. How it happened is because I was thinking about lots of things that other writers think about. So I don't think I was in any way original. But I was thinking about the fact that anyone who's got younger children, they can do everything on the internet, can't they? They can do everything with their phones, they can do everything, and you just sit there being a moron going, can you load down that music for me? I don't know where it's gone. What is the button? All that crap. So there was that. I thought about the fact that teenagers don't think about consequences, and I thought about the thing that they go on about in school all the time, which is that nobody knows who anyone is on the internet.
So that's why we've got Hacked and Alias are these types. That makes sense to me now, yes. Right.
And so basically I thought I'd write a book about hacking, and actually I don't know anything about hacking apart from what I'd read in the papers and all that kind of stuff. But I went round to somebody who does know about that kind of thing, and I said, can you tell me what can you hack? And he looked around his kitchen and he said, you could hack a toaster. And I'm like, that's going to be a great book. So why would
hashtag
you want to hack a...
Hack
the toaster. Why would you want to hack a toaster? And he said to me, you didn't ask me what I'd want to hack. You said, what can you hack? And then he said, well, I think it'd be really cool to hack a drone. And off I went.
As in a flying, unmanned...
Well, the actual honest truth is I said, that sounds great. What's a drone? Thanks. You as well. So then I found all about drones. And then, of course, actually, without wanting to do a political manifesto, it's horrendous, the whole drone wars thing. So I wrote a book about somebody who meets someone on the internet that he thinks he knows who they are, but he doesn't know who they are, and he's a clever kid, and he does something kind of for a dare, and then the ramifications are enormous, basically.
Sounds worth reading, don't you think?
Maybe.
No, look, I mean, the thing is, when we... I don't know how many grown-ups in here would read young adult fiction or even children's fiction. Hands up if you do. Do you do that because... Greg, do you do that because you are interested in it or because you're just sort of young at heart? Because you've got a seven-year-old that you read to. Oh, I see. OK. You're not planning... When's your first series coming out, then? No? Stokescroft Child. No? How about over here? So are you writers of children's fiction as well? Is that why you read it? Or why... Go on. Why do you read children's...
Yeah.
I just read the whole series from
Norton
Foster's when I was Mallory Blackmore. Brilliant. My son's got your books, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he realised them. He's told me I should read them. I will now.
So we've got a Mallory Blackmore fan down here. Okay, yeah. Fantastic. See, when we were talking about this, Tracy, earlier in the week, we were saying... Things that you were talking to me about vocabulary, and you were to some extent talking to me a little bit about ideas and so on, and how it's a slightly different layer of communication that goes on. And you go into schools very, very regularly, don't you?
I do.
So tell us a little bit about that sort of area.
Well, I don't know quite what I think about that, but basically I go into schools and I talk to teenagers, and as you can imagine, it's really hopeless to try and be cool. I don't try and be cool, and I don't try and be funny, and I don't try and speak like them. And it's really a bit the same with the books. The thing about young adult fiction, I think, if you want to have anyone read you, is you can't pretend to be them. You, all you can do is you can put yourself back in, well, if I was 16, but you have to absolutely be in their shoes. But I can't try and, I don't try and mimic the language, because I think you just fall on your face kind of thing with that. And when I go into schools, because I just feel like they don't, you know, reading's not that cool, and I'm a 50-something woman, and I'm not cool. So actually what I do in the schools is they think I'm going to drone on at them, but actually... because I've had a few things where there are some kids who can't even understand, you know, some of the language I might use or whatever. I just have a whole other way where I let them run the sessions. So I get them talking about hacking. They all know about hacking. So I ask them what they know. And they kind of run it all. And then I get two of them up. I always pick troublemakers, which is great because they're more fun at the front. But I don't obviously know who they are, but I've got a radar. And then they just say what they think they... would have to say if they were writing the book themselves about Hacked. So then they can say anything they like. They can say Lizard Squad and all the cool things or whatever. And then I just talk about everything they write. And I talk about it really quickly. And they have to cross the thing off that I've said as quickly as they can. And I pretend to miss them all and it's a mess. And that's a bit like also how I slightly write the books. You can't... I don't want to talk down to them. I just want to imagine that I was that boy. I'm Dan and I'm really good at code. And I met this someone online, and I made a really good friendship with this person online, and then that person online wasn't who I thought they were, and then I got in a mess. But I do think that I write young adult fiction because I like to... I read all the Twilight books and the Hunger Games and all that. It's great. I don't care what anyone says. It's great. I was totally in there. And I just want a kid to read a book and feel like that about it, to just think, I really like Dan. I'm so worried he's in trouble. What's going to happen in the end or whatever? It's fun. It's fun to write. And what I actually think about young adult fiction is that you have to get into the story quicker. And that's why I think a lot of people like it, because there isn't that luxury maybe of... an adult who's a very experienced reader thinking, oh, I'll go with the writer and I don't mind if there's five or six chapters before I know what's going on. And you can't do that with young adult fiction. It's nice. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Have you got a little section you would like to...
I could just read... Yeah, I could read a little bit.
Would you like a sample?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah?
I can only actually see you and you're my favourite now. So I'm going to read to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you... Would you mind holding my beer?
With pleasure.
Okay.
It might not be that much left.
I have to stand up. Where's the light? Is there any light?
There is light.
Okay, I'm coming. Okay.
Turn to Jesus. There's light.
Okay, I can read. I can't turn the page, though. How am I going to do that?
You think I'm joking?
Okay.
Go on.
You turn the page. Okay. So this is Angel. And Angel is on the run. And Angel is 17. I went from London to Swansea to Glasgow to Birmingham, too scared to check into a hotel. As the train approached Leeds, my final destination, I washed my armpits in the loos and, with a trembling hand, plastered my face in the cheap makeup I'd bought from a skanky chemist. I stank of 3 days travelling and a lifetime's fear and disappointment. I was exhausted and terrified of being recognised. My story was all over the papers, accompanied by one of two photos, a blurred one with my eyes half closed and a school mugshot from year 11. It was difficult to imagine anyone recognising me. The last-minute makeover had done its job, but that didn't stop me feeling wired. There was no reason why anyone would trace me to Leeds. I had no link with the place. But Drone Jacker was the news. Who wouldn't be a bit jumpy? I walked briskly along the platform. The short-term plan was simple, to hide myself among the thousands of students. I kept repeating the name Saffron to make sure I reacted naturally when someone used my alias for the first time. That someone happened to be Mac. "You a student?" he said. I assumed the little boy in front of me was talking to someone else, but when I looked around, I was the only person left on the platform. "Yes," I said. "You getting a taxi?" "No," I said, wishing I'd ignored him. I put my ticket into the slot and pushed the turnstile. He ducked underneath. "Great." "Are you walking then?" "Yes," I said. I'd get rid of him once we were out of the station. "I'm Mac." Social niceties were so not top of my agenda, but I decided I might as well try out my new name. "I'm Saffron," I said, "and I really don't want company." "Me neither," he said, which, bizarrely, given how frightened I felt, made me laugh. I turned left out of the station and he came too. There was a man in uniform bang in front of us. Instinctively, I looked away and as a result stumbled slightly. Mac noticed. "It's only a traffic warden," he said. I needed to get a grip. If even a small boy could tell I was nervous, I'd be locked up in no time. I made a snap decision. "Are you hungry?" "Always," he said. "Know any good cafes?" Mac grinned and led me down a back street to a burger bar. It was useful having him by my side. The whole world was looking for a solitary girl, whereas with him I was clearly one of a pair. I relaxed a little. Mac asked for a cheeseburger, chips and a Fanta, and I had the same. Your brain needs food and rest. I hadn't had enough of either. You smell, he said. You don't have to sit so close, I said. I wondered if he was cold. I was wearing a hoodie, but all he had on was a grubby short-sleeve football shirt. In between eating with his mouth open, it became clear he spent his time latching on to strangers, hoping for food, drink, money, or all three. Where do you live, I asked. Delph Lane. I let him explain where it was. Turned out we were heading the same way. Suited me. I had a guide in the shape of... How old are you then? 9, he said. A 9-year-old boy. I'd assumed I'd have to risk a hotel, at least for a few days. But Max said there was a postcard in the window of the Hyde Park Corner post office advertising a room. Whereabouts, I asked. Don't know, he said. But you're the one who's telling me there's a room, the lady from the cafe said. It was like a word game. I persevered. It turned out that Max couldn't read, but happened to be outside the post office when the lady from the cafe had quoted the ad, pointing out what an astronomical price it was. He had several goes at astronomical. I rang the number on the card and was invited straight round. You'll be the first viewing, said the voice. Young, male, southern. Mac would have come with me, but as far as I was concerned, his job was done. Nice meeting you, Mac. Same. See you around, Saffron. He disappeared off. I didn't give him another thought, because I had no idea he'd be part of my story. It's actually meant to be a thriller, but that's not that thrilling, is it? But my husband likes the bit with Mac, so there we go.
Thank you very much, Tracy. A big round of applause, please, for Tracy. And I've just got one question. Seeing as you often young adult author, young people's author, children's author, you often kind of go around with wares, with merchandise. Do you perchance have merchandise this evening?
I have got my books, £5 each. For
That's
the festival, absolutely. If you want one, if not, they're in all the libraries.
Fantastic. So look out. We'll have some of Tracy's books out later, probably down here. So towards the end of the show this evening, we'll have some out here, and you can come and have a chat further with Tracy and buy her a Peroni. Peroni. Very nice. Okay. There's your Peroni.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tracy. And I'm handing back to Christy now.
I can't. I don't have to put it back in. Sorry.
Look at that. Woman puts microphone back in stand.
Right.
Yeah? Thank you. Here I am. Hello. Okay, so we've got three more short storytelling readers. That went well. but before that, we're going to turn the tables, and our illustrious Stoatscroft writers have chosen their top two finish the lines. Exciting. So let's all, let me remind you of what is at stake. It's an exclusive, bound to be worth extortionate amounts of money in the future, Talking Tales badge! I love you guys, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to read all the second place ones first. Yeah, that made sense. Okay, in my younger and more vulnerable years, my father always said to me, the monsters under the bed, they are real. Sleep quietly and deeply, or they will eat your toes clean off. Nice. Yes, yeah, yes. Second place. So second place for number two. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was turbulent, obviously. Second place. Bob loved jelly, but didn't know how to contain the wobble in his big round belly. So close, yet so far. No, just close. Oh, Jesus. So for first, the winner for the first one. In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father always said to me, son, get her on the pill, it feels better. No, nice. And then it says in brackets afterwards, true story. It's just, which is just weird. So who wrote that one? Or if you don't want to announce yourself, and you can... well, Mel will be giving you a badge if you want to claim it at some point. Or if not, you just slink back into the darkness. First place for number two. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was my birthday, and I was completely alone. Placing the 99 candles on my cake was a chore, but they burned bright. Very nice. Aww.
Anita! Have you got a badge?
Yes, well done. Yeah, you can give up your job now. That's pretty priceless. And so the last one, number three. Bob loved pretending to be middle class, but didn't know how to put creme fraiche on an ordinary meal and deem it a dish. Let's see, write that one. Okay, good, John! Okay, so thank you all for competing in Finish the Lines. So we'll get on with our last three readers of the evening. So, Kevlin Henney has only just learnt how to walk forwards. He spent his formative years thinking everything was moving away from him. It was a very confusing time. Or, I couldn't choose between these two. Kevin Henney got his name after a fight to the death with a man named Kelvin. His real name is Jeff. Please welcome to the stage, Kevlin Henney.
Right, some or all of that might actually be true. I don't remember the fight, though, but I won. Okay, I write flash fiction, so this is over in a page. It's called Possession. Mass was getting heavy. Father Higgs wagged his finger from the pulpit while Mrs. Lamb called us all fucking sheep from the back. Framed by overcast light from the doorway, she conducted her litany with a walking stick. Father Higgs preached on while the congregation pretended Mrs. Lamb was seated at her pew, quietly, on her own, taking in the sermon, as she did every Sunday. All eyes were forward, except the father's and the children's and Jimmy's and mine. Today, more than any other Sunday, Father Higgs' habit of writing his homilies out longhand delivered some salvation for both him and his flock. Whenever he stumbled, thrown by a fucker, or a bastard, or an arsehole, he looked down to find the next word he wanted to spread, while Mrs. Lamb improvised something somewhat less sacred. We had a bet, and it looked as if I'd won. Jimmy and me had stumbled across a drug cache last week at school. Hard and soft, upper and downer, legal and not. We'd bet each other we couldn't use them at church on Sunday. But there were only three commandments. Target one person only, so no lacing the wine. The effect must be obvious at some point during the service, so we'd have to dose our mark beforehand. The most daring or outrageous effect won the remaining stash. Nice one, Jimmy whispered in my ear. Yeah, speed, angel dust, pure caffeine and Prozac, I think. Mrs. Lamb showed no signs of slowing. The children of the congregation hung off every word of this broader, more profane education. Even Father Higgs seemed to be losing his cool, increasingly tripping over his words and looking down at his hands, now lit by a break in the cloud outside. Mrs. Lamb always stops for a snack outside. Before the service, I said, I've never known her refuse a biscuit. Jimmy nodded, his eyes on Father Higgs, and leaned over. Did you know he likes a shot of something more spiritual before the service? I looked at Jimmy. He smiled. Watch. Father Higgs had lost his interest in both his and Mrs. Lamb's exegeses. He looked up at the light falling through the windows, through angels illuminated and halos glowing, with mouth open and eyes wide. Oh, said Father Higgs. L, whispered Jimmy. My S. God. D. Respect, I nodded slowly. We have a winner.
Keep it going for Kevlin Henney. Okay. Anita McCallum. I've only just met, so I haven't had a chance to have her followed to gather facts. So this is what I've gathered so far. Anita is a Bristol-based writer specialising in poetry, prose and script writing. She writes about people living on the edge of society, mental health and feminism. Transformation compels her, and she's inspired by stories of positive activism. She's a full-bodied writer with a nutty aftertaste. Please clap many times for Anita McCallum.
Oh, thank you. Is that close enough?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, thank you. Okay, I've got a story called Cold Concern. There's something in the road. I can see it from my bedroom. The lamppost light paints it the colour of nicotine. It's hard to make out what it is with the snowflakes falling. I do know people around here are really careless, disposing of things that they don't want. They just drop stuff in the road. It's definitely not someone's pet. It's not a dead cat. Not like last time. It's not quite flat enough. An animal would have to be run over to be in the centre of the road like that. Whatever it is, it's wrapped in material or swaddling. It would fit snugly into the crook of my arm. And with that thought, the blood in my veins picks up pace and my breath steams up the glass and distorts my vision. I'm left staring into my own misted reflection. I really want to go and hold it. Rock it, softly, next to my skin. I want to touch it. I just need to stop looking. Adrenaline drives me down the stairs like a hand on my back and into the kitchen. I'll just make a cup of tea to stop myself obsessing. I get like this. An idea forms in my head and I can't help myself. I just want it to be real so badly that in some strange way it is. Making tea soothes me. The consistent time it takes, a kettle boiling, mug, tea, milk. I know the exact colour my tea has to be, a sort of digestive biscuit colour. Not that I eat them anymore, I can't quite afford the inches around my waist. The smell of the tea is also important. I know if the kettle has been boiled too many times or the milk is about to turn, it just smells loveless and chewy, a little bit solid, almost cheesy. You have to take care. I have to have my special mug. It's curved, bowl-like, and it fits snugly into my hand. Opening the cupboard door, I feel my heart beat steady as I see my favourite mug. Blues and greens swirling in the pattern, it allows my eyes to rest. The curved outside gives my hand something to cup and my skin craves a contact. The idea of a baby in the road has left my insides turning over and I take my mug into the lounge to optimise my tea drinking. Sitting in my rocking chair, it's not just wooden but cushioned and fashioned in a way that allows me to feel held with no obligations or consequences. As I sit in my chair with my tea, drinking slowly, my thoughts flow freely into past memories, beach days, with endless sea, my children small and amazed by every grain of sand, burying their feet and rediscovering them. Burying their feet and rediscovering them over and over again. Happy days. What's that sound? Can you hear it? Can you hear that sound? Can you hear that sound? It's a meowing or a crying or something. Can you hear it? Can you? Whatever it is, it's totally ruined my beach fantasy. I'm back here in this place, in the lounge, photos of the children on the wall, my son brown-eyed and handsome looking down at me from high. He was named after his dad, Peter, my rock-solid presence. At least he was until he left. He wanted to move on, and me, I can't be anywhere but right here. Sarah, my first daughter, is there. perched high on the mantelpiece, staring blankly ahead, a lip-curling smile giving away her inside self. There's that sound again. Surely you can hear it. It's a cat or something, definitely. Oh, yeah, I can hear the clatter of the cat flap. And there's Tigger running in, her tail's puffed up the size of a loo brush. The bloody neighbour's cat is always trying to hump her. She hasn't quite worked out how to say no. I used to have that trouble with my husband. As I look at my cup, I can't quite believe it's empty. There's that sound again. I can hear it. I can hear her crying. The baby's crying. God, I'll bloody drive myself mad. It's not a baby. That is bloody ridiculous. I look out the lounge window, but can only see snowflakes falling. I'm not going out there. Last time I thought I heard her crying, I ended up in a police station for the night. They locked me up. And I only picked that baby up, you know. I was only trying to help. Poor thing, it was crying, left outside the shop, on its own. I've just got to stop thinking. I know, I'll grab a book, I'll do some marking. That's got to be done before next week, anyway. Even though my children are grown, I'm still weighed down by others' futures. Always wanting more feedback, more guidance, more of me. I told the class they had to write about their weekend. I know, I'll start marking Stephen Jones. He takes my mind off things. He never holds back. I'm almost embarrassed to see his parents at parents' evening now. There it is again. Surely you can hear it. That's definitely not an animal sound. That is a baby crying. I'm going to look outside. I can't concentrate on anything anyway. Out on the road is a small bundle of rags or something, and I've only got my socks on. My favourite ones, fluffy. It's cold and wet, though, so I need to be quick. I swear that bundle just moved just then. A rumble from up the street and there's a car coming. I'm going to pick it up, whatever it is. It'll get squashed, and I couldn't live with myself if red flash sped past, and before I can make it, in that split second, before I know for sure, I saw an arm poke out of that bundle of material. In flashes, like strobe lights, I see a baby in the road, a car drive over it, and I'm on my knees, the car gone, ghost baby in the sludge, grey matter in the middle of the street. I get up and go to it and touch the fabric it's wrapped in. Cold and wet, a corner of material sticking up, and I hold it to me. It smells of petrol, and I sit in the middle of the road, my womb void. I bear only dead fruit. I rock this empty shell of nothing, staring at a discarded blanket left in the middle of the road. The baby is gone. It was never there. She was never there. There's nothing left except a bit of old cloth and my leftover thoughts.
Round of applause for Anita McCallum. Okay, so now our last story of the evening from our very own Stokes Groff writer. Christopher Fielden was raised by Robert Kilroy Silk in his garden shed, which explains the warped views he holds today. Big round of applause for Christopher Fielden!
I'll go here. Evening. I sound like Robert, don't I? Colour of my skin's the same too. This is a story called Death of a Superhero. Name?
Batman!
Death looked up from where he was seated on the throne of bones, behind the desk of deliverance, in front of Death's door. Although dressed like Batman, the person standing before him didn't exhibit the level of physical fitness you might expect to see from a successful crime-fighting vigilante. For one thing, there was an unacceptable disparity between their height and their girth. Said disparity would probably make leaping from buildings, running quickly, or fitting into the Batmobile somewhat problematic. The person also seemed to possess a general lack of understanding regarding Batman's gender. "Nice suit," said Death.
"Thanks."
Batman obviously had no concept of sarcasm either. Death looked back at his recent expiry's manifest. He tapped the page with a bony finger. "You're listed here as Doris Claymore," he said.
"Never heard of her," said Batman.
Death reached out and stroked the decaying blade of the scythe that rested against his desk. "This is quite simple, Doris. To progress peacefully into the afterlife, you need to confirm your name. It means I can be certain of who you are, what you've achieved in life, and therefore where you should spend eternity." Death dished out his best stare. As glares go, it was pretty impressive. In the past, it had made stars think twice about shooting. "Can you tell me your real name, please?"
"Already told you. I'm Batman."
"How can I put this politely?"
"No need to be polite," said Bat Doris. "Got skin as thick as armadillos, us crime fighters."
Given the invite, Death decided to be blunt. "Not only is Batman fictional, he..." Death left a pause, which he hoped would scream with meaning. "Is a man."
"And?"
"You have breasts."
"They're pecs!"
"No, they're breasts," said Death. "And Lycra does little to mask their magnitude. I feel I should add that Batman was always depicted as an athletic individual at the peak of physical fitness. Clearly, you're not." A tear trickled from beneath Doris's mask, suggesting her skin might not be as thick as she'd led Death to believe.
"Okay," she whispered. "Point taken."
Despite the scythe, the rotting cloak, and the distinct lack of flesh coating his crumbling bones, Death was a sensitive individual. He disliked causing upset. Most people found the experience of dying traumatic enough without him being disagreeable. In a more gentle tone, he said, "Good. What's your real name?"
"Bruce Wayne!"
Death took a moment. His was the greatest of jobs, an eternal vocation no other would ever undertake. The pride he felt in this most trusted position was indescribable, the honour overwhelming. Still, on certain days, the downsides of immortality became glaringly apparent, and he realised how lucky mortals were to die. This was one of them. "You're not Bruce Wayne," said Death, deciding it was time to unleash some even harder truths. "Or Batman. Your name is Doris Claymore, and in life you are a fat, frumpy nurse." Another tear appeared beneath the mask and trickled down Doris's chubby cheek. Death felt guilty. He'd allowed irritation to control his words, creating insults where he should be showing more respect. Eternal life would be dull without the challenges people like Doris presented. One of the lessons he'd learned by existing for as long as other things had been dying was the art of patience. It would be a shame to forget that lesson today. There would be a reason why Doris was behaving in this manner. It was Death's duty to discover the reason and deal with it. He decided to try a different tack. "How did you die, Doris?"
"I was doing some vigilante stuff, you know. Chasing a psycho across rooftops, that kind of thing."
"And?"
"I did a jump from one building to another and missed."
Given that Doris probably had a bodily mass similar to that of a baby rhino, it wasn't hard to imagine gravity prevailing while she battled with thrust, momentum, distance, and the laws of physics. "That's exactly what I have written here," said Death.
"See? I'm telling the truth."
"Next to the name Doris Claymore."
"Must be a typo."
It also says that you were at a superhero convention, had a Jaeger bomb or 17... Death paused and double-checked the number. "A Jaeger bomb or 17 too many, got a bit carried away. Does that sound familiar, Doris?"
"Stop calling me Doris!"
A tremble in Doris's voice caused Death to look carefully at the woman standing before him. Fear danced in her eyes and she kept glancing over his shoulder. It's the door, isn't it? Asked Death. Doris nodded. Death's door was huge and set into a wall of light behind the desk of deliverance. The portal was sinister, black and fleshy. Blood oozed from its surface, which gave the impression the door might be alive, but only just. Death often wished he could alter its appearance. And the foul smell that emanated from it. But there were always barriers to major changes in the realm beyond life, including politics, beings who believed they were gods, the dead's expectations and laws dictating the way things should be. Sometimes it was easier not to bother.
It's going to judge me. Send me to hell, said Doris.
Judgment is my job, Death replied, and there's no such place as hell.
You said what I've done in life tells you where I should spend eternity.
I did.
I haven't done anything.
Doris looked at the door again.
Well, I've done plenty, but none of it was much good.
And Batman did lots of good things, right? Doris nodded.
I'm going to a bad place, aren't I?
Death looked back at his notes. You were a nurse in a children's hospital working on a cancer ward. It says here that you were good with children. You could put them at ease, even in the most difficult of circumstances.
Anyone can do that.
Death shook his skull. It's a difficult thing to do. I can see why you sought escapism by drinking and playing superheroes. But you were gifted. You did a great job of good with your life. You helped others.
Lots of people help others.
True, but you were better at it than Batman. A smile crept onto Doris's lips.
You're good at this.
Thank you, said Death. Doris pulled off her mask.
Sorry if I was difficult.
Death saw that all the tension had left her. She looked radiant and, more importantly, ready to state her title. What is your name? Asked Death.
Doris Claymore.
Death stood, hefted the scythe, and tapped it against the door. There was an unpleasant squishing sound. Fresh blood oozed from the door's surface. As if this meant some toll had been paid, the portal swung open, revealing Doris's pathway, a glimmering road that led through the stars and galaxies towards the Ever. This is your path beyond life, Doris Claymore, said Death. May it bring you peace. Doris stepped through the doorway and embraced eternity. The door shut behind her. Death rested his scythe against the desk and sat on his throne. Next, he said, looking through the manifest, trying to find his place. He heard some shuffling footsteps. Without looking up, he said, Name? Wonder Woman, replied a gruff voice. For fuck's sake, said Death.
All for Talking Tales. I want to say thanks for coming this evening to listen to writers perform on a Saturday night rather than laying face down drunk in the gutter. So I'm very proud of you all, unless you're planning on getting that in later as well. So all power to you. The next Talking Tales is going to be on Monday, the 14th of December, with the wonderful Thomas David Parker doing a Christmas special. He had some fans. The buckets for donations are going to go around, so please help us support starving festivals. And then Yari is going to just close. Are you? Yeah, so just one last big round of applause for everyone that performed. Writers, short storytellers, flash fiction, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. I'll not bore you, but I want to thank everybody that helped to make this festival happen, because this is our final event, and this is our sort of closing words, I guess. In a minute, we're going to welcome to the stage Long for the Coast, who are wonderful, and I hope you give them your fullest of attention. Perhaps we'll take a sort of 5 minutes while you get yourselves sorted out and everyone can grab a drink and so on and so forth. But I want to say thank you to everybody that's pulled together this year, because what's made it really interesting, I think, is that all the events, like Christie's events, or, well, I know you and your mates, but you know, everyone, There's so many people have come together to do pieces of this festival, and I just want to be really, really, you know, just give a big round of applause to that fact, please, because it's people who've previously been to the festival or previously have just said, look, let's do something about the creative word in this city, coming together. And I can see Amy over here, and you know, you've done marvels for this festival this year. There's Mike at the back chatting away when I'm talking. Oi. And then there's Richard probably as well doing the same thing because he can't be bothered. Anyway, there's so many of you in this room who've actually pulled together and done a wonderful job this year. And I'm just so, personally, I'm really, really proud of what you've done. And I've missed so many people out, but you know who you are. And so I'd just like everybody, please, to give a big round of applause to all those who pulled together and made such a great week. Well done, well done, well done. And what did I say? What did I say at the beginning? I know I sounded spooky. I said the creative word is here to help us kind of figure out what we're here for and sometimes help us to confront death. Didn't I say that? And you thought I was just being spooky. All right, let's take a short break. And after that, we'll welcome back Long for the Coast. And they're just... Tom, what are you rolling your fingers at me? You're going to just put them on straight away. Okay, Tom's going to put them on straight away. Cheers, everyone. God bless and keep you.
Hello again.
Hello. We're Long for the Coast, or preferably Sophie and Jamie. Woo. Thanks a lot to all of our mates who have come down to hear us play from Cardiff as well as around Bristol.
And Farnham.
And Farnham.
Yep. And home Farnham. Counties.
This song's called Compass. In the middle of your chaos, take a second to realign. We're in the backseat of your car with stolen wine. Today is another day. And tomorrow, will I compromise my callings and my time? I abandon my ideals behind a smile. Am I just killing time? Am I just killing time? But I'm asking more questions than I claim to have answers, and learning new verses and severing passes. I walk in my compass, just on brass and magnets. I don't owe them anything, but I'm desperate to fix this. For those late nights, when my tears fall from my tired eyes, soaks through to my chest and breaks my heart. But to see you like this, but to see you like this. Thanks a lot.
You have been listening to Talking Tales, the podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to tell us what you thought, are interested in performing at an upcoming event, or just want to know when the next event will be held, visit www.stokescroftwriters.com or look up Stokescroft Writers on Facebook or Twitter. Talking Tales is a bi-monthly event held in Bristol, UK. It is organised by Stokescroft Writers and hosted at the Left Bank on Stokescroft. Thanks for listening.